So this evening is a little bit different in that we'll have give the opportunity for a question and answer session. There's way more questions than we'll ever find answers to. So we'll sort of do what we can, and won't keep you up too late either. I'll just begin. And we'll alternate back and forth, more or less. This is a question. How does one know if one has had an insight or if one has just had another deluded thought? Is an insight a, quote, wordless knowing, unquote, or can it involve conceptual discursive thought? If one is having deluded insights, one isn't likely to know they're deluded, or are they? Is this more than one question? It's actually an excellent question, because the how do we know? Because some things are, you have the, and one doesn't have to look very far into religious history to see the plethora of extraordinarily deluded insights. I think one of the things that I tend to refer back to is the say the difference between a in the English we call it wholesome or unwholesome. In Pali it's kusala and akusala, citta, the wholesome mind state or unwholesome mind state. And as it progresses, I mean, in the sense of there's a characteristic, and kusala is wholesome, skillful, in accordance with Dhamma. I mean, it has these all those connotations, so that the inherent nature of that which is wholesome, skillful, in accordance with Dhamma, is that it's peaceful, there's a quality of happiness there, there's clarity, there's an attenuation or alleviation of suffering, so that those are and they're really good reminders in terms of, because sometimes we have something, we have a kind of an insight into something, and but then it sets up, might set up sort of layers of agitation. And so that then that's a clue. Sort of saying, okay, well, maybe that's not in accord. That's not actually an insight that one should be questioning. What is that? And also one has to observe the results over time as well, because something can be, one can have a clear, powerful insight that brings enormous suffering to others as well. So one needs to be investigating that. So it's not a straightforward thing. And also that an insight, doesn't necessarily have to be a wordless knowing. Certainly the realm of conceptual thought and a true insight doesn't preclude wise thinking, right? So that it's important to recognize that there's a place for wise and skillful thought, so those are some parameters.
There were a lot of questions addressed to Ajahn, so I was suggesting that he do two to my one. But we'll go like this and see what happens. This was a great question. Just the kind of situation we find ourselves in a lot. When one is in the midst of an unpleasant situation, for example, one is very stressful because one is running out of time trying to meet a deadline, what should one do? Does one focus on the bodily sensation at that time while trying to do the work at hand? There are tremendous negative forces at the time distracting one from concentrating on anything. Ain't that the truth? So just that last bit kind of precludes this sense of trying to find the samadhi. There's a lot of forces at work in a moment like that, and can make it very difficult for us to find our base again. But I find, and maybe in that situation, certainly I'll come to that in a moment, but I think a question like this, or the realization of these kinds of things happening so frequently in our lives, can serve as a tremendous reminder of the importance and the value of cultivating samadhi. This is the antidote for this kind of thing. In terms of just sitting on a regular basis and endeavoring to cultivate this force in our lives, I think it's very good to contemplate difficult situations like this, to give us the fuel and the reminder, the remembering to do that. So, because it's clearly a situation when one has lost one's samadhi, to say the least. So you can look at, this is what life is like without that wonderful capacity to be still and be at ease. So that in a moment like that, I mean, even just taking that, like, just to be able to articulate a question like this means that some bit of us knows that we're in a state, some bit of us knows that we're in a state. So looking at that, and in that moment, there can be the realization that this is a life without ease and without relaxation, driven to follow impulses, driven to follow difficult states like this over and over again. It's just like a storm that keeps feeding itself. When Ajahn was talking the other night about the two causes of suffering, ignorance and tanha, very important contemplation is to see how these two are linked with the two wings of our practice. That the samadhi, the capacity to concentrate, to relax, to be at ease, is the chief antidote for the craving, for that movement, that thing that's actually pulling us out and creating such distress in the moment. And the vipassana, or the insight practice, the understanding, is the chief antidote that we have for overcoming the ignorance. So really getting clear, this is what these tools are about. They're directly linked with the overcoming of these two causes of our suffering. I just made a note of this to myself. One of the definitions of samadhi is actually from the scriptures is having removed desire and aversion for the world. You know, that capacity, having removed desire and aversion for the world. And that's what's operating in these stressful and difficult moments. So, yes, you know, one of the best things that you can do in order to recover is to go back to the body. You know, I think it's no accident that in the Satipatthana Sutta, where does the Buddha begin? You know, begins at the body, because so much of the torment that we're experiencing is in the mental realm, and it is so convoluted that it's like this sense of not even being able to get any footing in relation to it. So even just that image of getting some footing, you know, it takes you right down to your feet, down to the ground, and get some grounding in the physical form. So, you know, depending what the situation is, where you are when one is overcome with a state like this, you know, finding some way to bring it back to the physical form. So the breath can be very helpful. Yeah, you know, many a time caught in a stressful state like that, come back to the consciousness of the breathing and continue doing the task, because you've got a deadline. You know, that's the thing, you've got a deadline. I mean, this is our lives are very complex. And it's not that you can't be mindful and stay on task, you know. So just centering back into the body and remembering that the way that it's explained in that first stanza of the sutta is that the breathing will bring about, the focusing on the breathing will gradually bring about even a greater movement into the full body experience. And that's what we want. Okay?
Okay, the next question is directed to me. At the end of your morning teaching, you said, quote, return to the knowing, unquote. Please say more about this and how I can know I'm experiencing the knowing and not just the ego, I and me. This is like such a central piece of the practice and what we're cultivating and say what we're cultivating it for, that this quality of knowing clearly, is depicted in so many ways. Just from the base of mindfulness, of that on that level of knowing, awareness, and one of the things that just reflecting on the name. The word Buddha, in Thai in particular, the first translation that is usually used in terms of when one translates Buddha, it means the one who knows. So that's sort of the clue when the how central that is. Okay, the name of the Buddha, the one who knows, right? And this sort of knowing bit is really important. And then we start. Well, then what should I know? How should I know? where should I know? it gets into the doubt or the analyzing or the trying to figure it all out, and it's much more how do you rest in a quality of knowing that doesn't then drift off into the proliferating or the doubting or the trying to grasp it as sort of the one who knows me, that's me, that's who I'll be. It's just a, because it's, you know, soon you can feel that sense of I. It's usually not very subtle. It sort of reaches up from the abdomen and grabs you by the throat. And it's just this, here I am. So that, it's, but the knowing and relating it back to the those qualities of that I talked about in the last question of the kusala jitta, the that which accords with Dhamma, is that which is peaceful, is clear, is free from suffering. Is not associated with the unskillfulness or unwholesomeness of within the mind, with, so that that knowing is more of a broad sort of sense of clarity. So I think that the measuring, how can I know I'm experiencing the knowing, is when there is that sense of ease and peacefulness and clarity and lack of agitation. Like sometimes the intrinsic. The intrinsic to akusala jitta, the unwholesome or unskillful states of mind. There's always a kind of an agitation there, so it's like that's a clue. Okay, when there's agitation or doubt, worry, then you say okay, that's. One recognizes that is an akusala jitta and can be, which isn't a. I mean, it's interesting as well that, from a Buddhist perspective, that this isn't, say, like a. One isn't. One's trying to look at it in the way of. Its usefulness, and that not to be. I had an unwholesome mental state. I'm a bad person, or I had an unwholesome mental state. Therefore, I'm a hopeless meditator. But it's like the one rec, because in terms of causes and conditions, the unwholesome can be. The cause for the wholesome. One recognizes, oh, that's unskillful. So that is a clue in order to direct attention to the skillful, to the peaceful. It's the nature of the mind to be revolving back and forth, so that then one settles back into that sense of knowing clearly, and having a clear sense of, say, what is in accordance with Dhamma, then there's an unwholesome mental state comes up, then you recognize that, you see that clearly, and then in class, okay, then how do I work with it? How do I deal with it? How do I relinquish that? How do I let it go? And so it's a motivation to be returning to that a base of increasingly clear and stable knowing. So it's I think that that's the theme that's getting drawn out in these last two questions around just recognizing the difference between these, what is the kusala jitta and the akusala jitta.
I'm working/practicing at staying composed and equanimous. As meditation deepens, I find some challenging emotions arise. I'm avoiding looking at its story so I can focus on the reactions in the body to whatever that story may be. And I've noticed the reactions in the body are identical to sensations of climbing the hill behind the meditation hall. So I imagine that I'm outside climbing the hill and feel the heart rate rise, heat, tension, when falling off balance, etc. This is much easier of a place to let go of the sensations because it cools any fears that may arise with the original story. Is this okay to do, or should I face the demons in its own costume instead of one that I've made for it? So we get the sense of this. This is a situation where the emotions that arise in relation to challenging emotions arising, and then trying to avoid going into the story about that, and then just seeing that. The reactions that go on feel very much like other ones. And should I relate? Should I go there? Is that okay? Or just stay with what's happening in the moment? Well, this is interesting. I actually had a little bit of a quandary kind of figuring out how to respond to this because on one level, it's okay to do that kind of thing if you found ease in getting a sense of what's happening in one situation, to sort of translate it or carry it over and try to apply it in another situation. So on the one hand, I want to say that that's okay. But on the other hand, I want to look at actually what would be more fruitful to me as an interested investigator and meditator in this situation would be to look at how even just in that movement of the mind, it's like I want to go to this other story or this other way of relating to it, that the mind is actually drawing an association with a place where it has known something before, you know, and to notice that, see that movement, and you can take this moment as a situation for seeing exactly how the mind is actually working. Sanya is fascinating, as I was saying the other night. It draws associations, and it's doing that virtually all of the time. So in a moment like this, it's remembering a time where these same feelings were occurring. Can you feel that? It's like it's going to a place where these same feelings were occurring. And I would be inclined to stay with that kind of insight right there. And just notice that that's what's happening in this moment. Sanya is a very powerful support, actually, for meditation. In a way, you know, the way I was talking about it the other night, it's looking at how the identification with Sanya as self can be problematic. But notice that Sanya, or that tendency to associate and to remember, can very much be active in the process of waking up as well. so that in a way you can go, you can see how in a moment like this, one is relating to a previous moment where the same kind of feelings were happening. And Sanya will do the same kinds of things with insight. It'll take this moment and relate it to other moments where it has understood. But as I said, my inclination would be to kind of stay with what's happening in the moment and realize that there is some kind of aversion happening here. There's a resistance and a contraction. And I found this kind of investigation very fascinating, a very similar thing in my own practice at one time where I was at Chithurst. And I was walking up the hill to the main house. And there's this point in the hill where climbing the hill gets a little bit difficult. It gets a little bit steep. And it's at that point that often I find myself starting to breathe heavier and have a difficult time getting up the hill. And I was watching at one point what my response to that was, and it was like everything in the system contracted around that moment. You know, the whole system collapsed, and then something that is already difficult becomes even more difficult because the system has seized up and is contracted. And so it becomes like, you know, you're climbing, and it's harder and harder and harder with each step. So that became a really powerful moment for me to see and how aversion works, how all of the hindrances work in a way. They'll come into play basically as a remedy for a situation that is already difficult, you know, and step in, and it's almost like they dangle themselves and say, you know, here's a solution. This is difficult. This is a difficult climb. I know what you can do. You can hate it. You can contract and tighten everything up. And it's like if you look at the hindrances, you know, each one of them is like the mind's best guess, the unawakened mind's best guess at what to do with difficulty, what to do with a difficult situation. So, you know, there's a huge potential for insight in these kinds of situations. So here you have a situation where things are difficult and there is contracting going around it. You know, my interest as a meditator then would be to stay right there and find out about aversion. How does it work? And is it the remedy that it presents itself to be? It's like it's coming in there and saying, do this, and this will make you feel better. I mean, isn't that amazing? It's like something is scary. Well, here, worry about it. Get anxious. You know, that'll help. Something is uncertain and difficult, you know. Keep thinking about it, you know, just keep thinking about it and you'll come to some kind of remedy, you know. Or like, just with desire, it says, this feels good. Okay, keep doing it, get more, keep, you know, lean into it, and then you watch where that actual movement of the mind is the very thing that takes us out of the pleasure. It's so weird. You know, each one of them has a lure and is telling us that it's going to help the situation. And it's doing just the opposite. It's like, I mean, you gotta love it, you know. It's so stupid. I mean, every one of the hindrances, I mean, all you have to do is scratch the surface just a little bit and see the utter and complete foolishness and absurdity of these as responses, you know, but we'll turn to them over and over again. Yeah, it's amazing. So Here you have a situation where something is difficult. So tighten up and contract, get constipated, you know, and see if that helps. I'm not sure if I answered that, but it was...
When you're mentioning the talking about sanya and perception, because it was brought, you know, as you mentioned, it was brought up as how you described it before, sort of something which is, you know, problematic, the perceptions of self, and that they're, you know, learning how to, you know, that there are other ways of using perception. It made me think of the Giri Mananda Sutta. Which is the in the Anguttara tens, and it's the Buddha brings up ten perceptions, and Giri Mananda is sick, and Ananda is told by the Buddha to go to the monk Giri Mananda and tell him 10 perceptions. It's possible that when he hears the 10 perceptions, his disease may be allayed, I mean, and also become peaceful. Which is, so the perception of impermanence, anicca sanya, perception of not self, anatta sanya, perception of unattractiveness, asubha sanya, perception of drawbacks, seeing the drawbacks, the limitations, sort of the pitfalls and things. The perception of abandoning, relinquishing, letting go. I can let that go, because usually we sort of perceive this, say, it gloms on, and this is permanent. But you can just turn that around. You can develop the perception of, well, that can be abandoned. I can let that go, and the perception of dispassion, of cooling, of a sense of a real settling, perception of cessation, things ending, ceasing. See, the perception this Tanjia's translation, perception of distaste for every world. And I think it's sort of recognizing, again, sort of taking that, the drawbacks to a bigger degree, and sort of saying, yeah, there's limitations of whatever world or experience is. There's real limitations, and the perception of the limitation of all sankharas. Just to see, whatever sankharas, whatever is concocted, compounded, created, is undesirable, because it's never really going to fulfill. So it's a stepping back, and then the last one is the perception of in and out breathing, mindfulness of in and out breathing. It's a useful sort of use where one uses perception to develop the qualities of within commensurate with Dhamma.
Well, I actually promised myself I wasn't going to mention George Bush on this retreat. So I was kind of glad to get a question. But actually, I think it's I might come back to it. It's sort of related to this other question, which I'd rather start with. The George Bush question is, any comments on the George Bush insanity and aversion? And then this other question, which actually has two parts. Can you please remind me again of some skillful ways to deal with anger? And then the second part also, how does investigation differ from thinking? And actually, I thought I'd talk about that tomorrow, so we'll save that bit of it, though. But can you please remind me of some skillful ways to deal with anger? This is a biggie, isn't it? There's a lot in the teachings about anger in terms of antidotes and things that we can do to address it. And the primary one that gets repeated is doing the metta practice. It's one of those things where sort of in the moment, when the anger is up, you know, it's sort of like it feels like it's a little too late at that point, you know. Certainly we've been in situations, I know I had one at the monastery one time where a fella just drove me nuts, you know, and I would get so pissed. And every time I would walk into a room, you know, and see him there, it would like, I was just ready. And sometimes I would go looking for him so I could hate him. He's just really wanting to get into a state about it, you know. But so what I would do for weeks, I mean literally weeks, I would be doing, may you be happy, may you be peaceful, may you be, and doing the metta phrases and all like that. And of course, you know, you can't fake it. I mean, it's not, that wasn't what was happening in my heart, you know. So, but then again, too, the metta practice does bring up the states that you need to look at, so that has to be said. But at any rate, finally, after a couple of weeks of trying to actually dispel it using metta, I actually turned in a way to the investigation of it, you know, and that came quite dramatically and suddenly in a moment where, you know, what, right in the midst of doing the phrases, you know, may you be happy, may you be peaceful, may you be free, I just stopped dead in my tracks and I said, I hate this guy. And just really let, I mean, it was so spontaneous and so real. It was like a lot more authentic than the previous moments, you know, where I was actually acknowledging what was happening for me in that moment. And then talking to one of the nuns about it, you know, and realizing that this is, in a way, the beginning of the end of the state. And also the point at which you need to greet that kind of moment with a lot of metta in your heart. You know, so it's like it's infinitely mindful, aware of what's happening, but also softened by this state that doesn't then turn it back on yourself, which is often the case, isn't it? You just kind of turn it back, what's wrong with me? Why am I so hateful? You know, so it has to be held in the heart with the optimal softness and kindness towards oneself. And I was telling Ajahn Amaro about this one time, you know, and I said, you know, the metta practice is great, but I'll be honest, I've never gotten past metta for myself, you know. And he said, well, that's good. You know, that's you know, where we need it most and right where you want to be. Just to keep doing that. I mean, if you spend a lifetime of trying to soften one's own heart so that in situations like this, we can at least short-circuit that tendency to turn it back on ourselves and hate ourselves, you know, complicate hating others with hating ourselves for doing it. So I found that to be very, very helpful advice. There's some other things that are said about working with this, that one can, you know, presumably when you're lost in a state of ill will or anger, it's towards a person or a situation or a condition in your life. And so that if it's towards a person, it's said to endeavor, you know, to contemplate, look for their good points. You know, and that's kind of like, you know, the when you've got a toothache, put your attention on your knee, you know, and it can be very, very helpful. Just go to the place, this stuff is coming at you, go to a place in our recollections of them to try to find a softness, you know, try to find the goodness. And actually, I did this with this fella, and you know, it was very, 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 very effective, because it made me realize that lots of times when people are unkind to us, and this was the case with this fella, it's like, you know, maybe that's all they know. You know, maybe it's like, you know, it's just a filter through which their effort to make contact is coming. You know, what if all you've ever known is thrashing and bashing and being beat up? You know, then the stuff that's going to come out of you is going to be that kind of behavior. And that actually turned out to be true in this case. I actually found out that this guy had a kind of crush on me, you know, and this was like his way of making contact, you know. He didn't know, you know, this was it. And I thought, that's amazing, you know, but it opens your heart, you know, if you can just not come back. I mean, the nature of this kind of stuff is, you know, this comes at you, you come back with this. Well, you know, what if you don't do that? What if you come back with a whole different state? Very, very effective. And it said that if it's an object or if it's a situation, to contemplate impermanence. You know, just to hold in the mind that this is this condition will pass. This is an impermanent condition, and it can be a great inroad for actually insight into impermanence. One of the things that's said is to contemplate karma, and I thought I'd mention this just to also bring some recollection and vitality to the things that we chant, because this is one of the chants that we do, that we're heirs to our karma. You know, what does that mean? We're the heirs to our karma. Well, this hatred that I feel right now is a fruit. It's a result of past actions. You know, I've been hateful in the past, and so it has a propensity to arise. And sure enough, here it is again. And so I, you know, it's like that situation of being stuck in your own stuff, you know. I did it before, and I'm about to do it again if I don't see this condition. And what can be very, very helpful in dealing with being the heirs to our karma is the realization that there is no unwholesome karma in the arising of that state. It's only in what we do when that state arises. You know, so that's huge. I mean, just consider that. That right there is the potential for freedom. And the sort of the point at which you can not accept your inheritance, you know. It's like, no, this, I do not accept this. I'm going to take a different path. You know, very, very, very rich, very powerful moment. One thing that can be very helpful in dealing with ill will is just contemplating the nature of these states. And I have found this to be very rich. It's like, just look at how huge these states are and how powerful they are. You know, Ajahn Suchito says, you know, sometimes even mindfulness is no match for a full-blown mental hindrance. You know, it'll just whoosh into the system and completely take it over. So, you know, contemplating that, you have to know that. You know, just consider. And that, I mean, I was telling some people in a group today, one of the very powerful moments in my own practice came when I sort of got it that I am ignorant. You know, the extent of that ignorance and the extent of the craving. And it sounds like doom and gloom, but it was a very happy moment. It was like, whoa, you know, this is going to take some time, you know. And it just kind of snapped me out of time and snapped me out of all the goal making and things like that about practice, you know, just settle down, you know, you're out to lunch and it's going to take some work. One of the things that I'm reminded of with this is that when I was on retreat one time with, and it was a long Upandita retreat, and I was doing walking meditation in the lower walking room at IMS, and there was a woman there who was doing the walking meditation with us, but she wasn't doing it right, you know, and she was doing, like, we were told to go slow, and then to go, you know, sort of go at a normal pace to begin with, and then go in the second period of the walking to slow it down a little more, and then at the third period of it to slow it down a little bit more. Well, she was doing just the opposite. So by the time you got really slow, she was racing, you know. and I was so annoyed, you know, so irritated by this. And it went on for days. And I kept going to the same walking lane, and she kept going to the same walking lane. And so there we were, you know. And I finally had the courage to acknowledge what was going on and to report it in an interview. And say, you know, this is what's happening, you know, I'm just getting really pissed off by this woman, you know. And so he says to me, anger arises easily. You should avoid the lower walking room. It was really helpful. It's like, oh, you know, I don't have to keep going here, you know. It's like avoiding the occasion of sin, you know, that kind of thing. Just acknowledging the extent, the nature of these states, you know, that's the way they do. And actually, that's also a reminder of another antidote, which is to associate with people who aren't that way. You know, that every one of the hindrances, this is one of the antidotes that the Buddha mentions. You know, you want to overcome being piggy, don't hang out with people who are piggy, you know. You want to overcome aversion and ill will, you know, find people who are tranquil and kind and hang out with those, you know. But it's not the way it goes. It's not the way we go naturally. Like, I deal with a whole lot of restlessness and agitation, and I find myself, looking for, you know, people that I can get crazy with, you know. It's like that's the, I want, you know, so what the energy wants to find it, its match, you know. Or you're drinking a lot of caffeine. That's what, you know, oh, I'm so restless, I'm so agitated. You know, drink some coffee. He's like, drink some coffee, that'll help, you know. That's what I'll do. It's nuts, you know. But just learning after years of doing that the, you know, you don't need caffeine, Gloria, you know, just stay away from caffeine. It's enough already. But one last thing, which is associated with the other one that came to mind, is the one winter I was at Amravati for the winter retreat, and Ajahn Sumedho was teaching it. Turns out, it was the winter of the first George Bush Gulf War. And, you know, that happened, I think it began in January. So the retreat is January, February, March. So here we were on retreat. Well, we had no knowledge that the war had begun or that there was a war happening out there, which was actually, that's an interesting contemplation in itself. You know, if a tree falls in the forest, you know it's happening, kind of thing. But anyway, since we didn't know what was happening, and this at the time was clearly an event that had implications for the whole planet, Ajahn Sumedho said he got himself a radio, and he started to listen to the radio, to listen to reports. And he said he hadn't listened to the radio for 20 years, 25 years at that time. But given this event, he wanted to keep up with it, and he wanted to be able to tell us what was happening. So he did, and he would tell us the stories, you know, about these smart missiles that could, you know, be launched from out in the ocean and go in the front door of the building, you know what I mean? It's like amazing technology, you know, that, and that we should have that kind of technology and use it in this way. It's like, you know, he would invite us to contemplate that. And then, but the big thing was he would invite us to contemplate how we felt about Saddam Hussein. You know, we could say the same thing about George Bush or about anybody, you know, these world leaders, how we felt about it. And just to really let it go, you know, let it rip. You know, he was the perfect tyrant, and you could really get some good hatred juices going in relation to this person. And so to do that, and you'd have us sitting there like that, and it's like, you know, you could feel it. And then he'd say, okay, now realize that what you're feeling right now is the hatred in your own heart. You know, it's not Saddam Hussein. It's not George Bush. It's the hatred in your own heart. And to contemplate that, to feel that, is certainly important for those of us practicing trying to overcome ill will, to consider how it is that we're holding these world leaders, the decision makers. I mean, it has to be said that, you know, we're living on a planet full of people who aren't awake. And some of the people who aren't awake, unfortunately, are people who have the power to make decisions that affect masses of people, and these kinds of things happen. And that's one way to sit with it.
There's a few questions that I thought I would, that have a particular theme that I'd like to draw out. And the first one is, say, it sounds like Ajahn Chah was an arahant from your comments about his relics. How do you know? Are there many living arahants now? Should you seek one out as a Dharma teacher? Another question is, what is a quote, transgression against the Dhamma, unquote, that we bow and ask forgiveness for during the evening chanting? What are some examples? And why do we do this practice of asking for forgiveness? Surely the Dhamma is bigger than us and doesn't need it. And they say, what is the benefit of having a relic on the altar? Does it help our meditation? And these, what I wanted to sort of point to with these questions as an answer is the role of faith in practice. That it is a you know, there's qualities of faith and the its attendant sort of secondary qualities of maybe a quality of devotion or a sense of humility, and so that there's, you know, that faith starts to split off into other qualities which are very useful for spiritual practice, and But also that, from a Buddhist perspective, that the faith is not a, say, like a required element, or it's considered a spiritual faculty, an indriya, considered a spiritual power, a bala, and but it's almost always in conjunction. I mean, it is always in conjunction with other qualities, so that the almost in any description of the qualities that are useful, and faith is mentioned, wisdom or wise reflection will almost invariably be in that same list, that same, so that there's this sort of faith and wisdom working together, faith and wise reflection working together. So that and also and it's very clear in the let's say, like the spiritual faculties or spiritual powers, those list of qualities that say following after faith is effort, so that faith which is working properly is then leading to effort in practice. So it's a very useful quality, because sometimes, say, our wisdom or our discernment faculties will keep us sort of thinking and thinking and thinking and analyzing and figuring out, and we don't actually have the time to put any effort in, because we've expended so much energy in the actual thinking processes. So that faith is something that gives the impetus forward, energy, effort, and that's very useful, necessary, helpful, a part of practice. It helps to cut through a lot of obstacles, but it's always tempered with that reflective practice and wisdom that is necessary. The whole element of forgiveness is a it's sort of tied into the aspects of faith, in that we're turning our attention to the qualities of faith, respect, devotion, deference, so that lifting something up higher than ourselves, in the sense of looking towards something as having, I say, worthy of respect, worthy of veneration, worthy of paying heed to, and to give ourselves to it. So that to be able to give ourselves to the practice, to give ourselves to Dhamma. And so that, that as I see it, is to say that, say, asking for forgiveness is not so much of literally that, but something that, an attitude that one is giving oneself the opportunity to open oneself more fully to, say, to Dhamma or to something other than one's own views, opinions, preferences, desires, and that's that can be very powerful. That whole aspect of forgiveness is it. I mean, there's many aspects to it, but the a lot of you here probably know Reverend Hung Shur from the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery. I mean, he did his whole PhD thesis on it. That was his thesis that he finally completed. it was really frustrating for him doing a say like an academic thesis on a spiritual quality, because he kept bringing writing things that weren't useful in an academic sense, but were very heartfelt and practice oriented. He said it was very frustrating for him, and especially that the element of say forgiveness, repentance, and how that's played a role in many spiritual Buddhist traditions and in Chinese tradition even more than say Theravada. But it's a sort of a as I see it, that giving ourselves the opportunity to step back from our a sort of self-orientation, and then have something worthy to give ourselves to, and that is very liberating for the heart, as we, because on a certain level, you know, we're never going to figure this out anyway, I mean, there's, you know, we can, and you know, there is, obviously, I mean, the Theravada tradition and the Buddhist tradition in general is extraordinarily refined nuances of philosophical and intellectual application, but it can only take one so far, and on a certain level, it's all you know, that relinquishing, letting go, isn't done with the with the analysis side of things. It's done with the face side of things, so that attending to that quality that also supports and encourages more the faith aspects. I think also we don't want to go too long.
No, I was going to.
Maybe one more.
Well, actually, I was going to suggest that I have three questions on, or four really, on stream entry. So I thought I'd save that for tomorrow. Uh-huh. Tomorrow night, yeah.
That's fine.
Yes, it's a
good place to start. There's a. I did want to bring up one. There's a couple of really short ones that just to mention. One is that somebody asked about the Lunar Observance Day, which is tomorrow, full moon tomorrow. Can see by our shiny heads, but we shaved before the observance days. I'll rather prefer to keep a more consistent schedule and not do a vigil. Although Some of us has been sitting up a bit later, so as people have, if people want to do a little bit more, then that's fine. But I'd opt for more consistency rather than sitting up through the night. Although we do it every week at the monastery. Sort of just a part of the rhythm of the monastery. And this one I really like. It said, when the monks bow, they touch the ground right hand, left hand, one after the other. Would you be so kind as to explain the purpose? And the sort of the ultimate purpose and the deep philosophical meaning is that we're just trying to not let our robes fall off. When you our robes are, the robe is just a square piece of cloth, and it's rolled up and it's sort of over the shoulder, so that and it just you end up just opting for that, where you're just sort of holding back a little bit, just trying to make sure it doesn't slip off. But when you don't have the robe on, I mean, definitely the coming down at the same time. But that's and then there was a question of asking, recommending a book on Anapanasati, or mindful approaches to the jhanas. So there's Ajahn Buddhadasa's. Ajahn Buddhadasa's book, what's it called? Something for serious beginners. Mindfulness of breathing for serious beginners. Yeah. That's a good one. It goes through the 16 stages of mindfulness of breathing. Larry Rosenberg's book on mindfulness of breathing, Breath by Breath. That's another book on mindfulness of breathing. Very good. Sort of the mindful approaches to the jhanas. Ajahn Buddhadasa probably talks a bit more about the jhanas, although he doesn't emphasize it that much in his book. Bhante Gunaratana has a book that is specifically on the jhanas. It was actually his PhD thesis that he did many, many years ago, and then it was refurbished, resurrected into a regular book that's on the jhanas. So those are books to take note of. And just for one last one to read, Tarnia says, which one is true? Nirvana can be realized in, number one, 21 days, number two, 21 years, three, 21 births, four, right now.